This podcast is an unedited excerpt from an MCLE program presented at MCLE's Conference Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Please note that MCLE's products, services, and communications are offered solely as an aid to developing and maintaining professional competence. The statements in this recording may not apply to your circumstances, and no legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice is being rendered by MCLE or its speakers. For full terms and conditions, please see the MCLE website.
Now moving on to the next segment, we have now a great topic that is my new favorite topic because since Me Too, it has changed a lot. Consent, what is and is not consent in 2021. We have two excellent presenters. Ladies first, we'll introduce Shannon Burns. She is a staff attorney in our Brockton office. She has practiced nearly 10 years now in Plymouth County and has had great success on cases involving consent and all the variations of it. And also with us today is Ian Palumbaum, and he is the chief of the Suffolk County District Attorney's Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Unit. But he's been with them now over 20 years, has prosecuted countless homicides, sexual assaults, and other complicated felonies. And so we're very lucky to have them both here today. Thank you so much, and we will hand it off to you.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. Ian Palumbaum. I know everybody's out there. I haven't decided whether to visualize a nice coffee shop type gathering or, you know, a stadium with 50,000 people, which would probably paralyze me with fear. The topic as it was presented to us to address was consent in as it appears in 2021. And there are ways it's changed and there are ways that it hasn't changed. It's changed more in terms of attitudes and approaches on both sides and all sides than it actually has in the law, with one notable exception I'll hit at the end of this. I mean, there are essentially two theories of the crime of rape, which I'll start with. One is by force and one is by incapacitation. The jury instruction and the elements for forcible rape really haven't changed for a very long time. There's a pretty detailed description of what constitutes intercourse for the first element, and penetration, however slight, and we won't really spend time on that. And then there's the force element. And the introductory part of the instruction, if you're using the model instruction, says, you know, second element, the Commonwealth must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the sexual intercourse was accomplished by compelling the complainant or the victim or the alleged victim to submit by force or threat of bodily injury and against his or her will. And then you're waiting for that part where the judge goes back and explains this element in detail. And all it basically says is the same thing again. Second element the Commonwealth must prove is that the intercourse was accomplished by force or threat of bodily injury and against the person's will. The force needed for rape may, depending on the circumstances, be constructive force as well as physical force, violence, or threat of bodily harm. There are, of course, supplemental instructions, which I think any prosecutor at least would be crazy not to ask the trial judge to make sure to include. Because that's where you get the language that's evolved, that's kind of more victim-friendly in these cases. If a person submits because of fear, it is not consent. You may consider evidence of the complainant's state of mind at the time of the incident on the issue of consent, and that the person is not required to use physical force to resist. You may consider evidence of resistance, but sometimes resistance may not be possible. I'm paraphrasing the instruction now, but that's essentially what it says. And then there's a further supplemental instruction that says that the jury may consider other aspects, the overall relationship between the parties, the age of the parties, the relative size. Is one person much bigger than the other? Is one person an authority figure in determining whether the somebody was forced to into the act against their will. I think what has changed over the years, and particularly in recent years, are the views within all those different factors of what's considered expected victim behavior. You know, come a long way from the idea that somebody needs to scream or resist or go right to the police after. You know, if someone didn't resist at the time, if somebody never overtly said no, if somebody just basically let it happen to them, or even actively went along, even did things like helping take their clothes off, or, you know, things that could be considered active participation. You know, because of the changing attitudes on that and on the effects of trauma of this happening to people, for one thing, people are more likely to report that they were raped to begin with. For the second, based on changing attitudes and changing training, the police are more likely to listen to it and not dismiss it. And people in my position screening these cases are more likely to cut people making reports some slack and not immediately say, gee, you know, it's not like we believe you, but we can't prove this. In addition, judges are more likely as time goes along to allow a victim to explain their thought process, or even for the Commonwealth to call an expert on the effects of trauma, not tied to the facts of the case, but some general principles in terms of what trauma does to somebody's mental state, their ability to resist, in some cases, their memory of things and how it might be fragmented. And of course, people on juries. I mean, jury selection is very important because from the Commonwealth's perspective, obviously, we want jurors who are willing to cut a survivor some slack if they didn't do things that you would, you know, stereotypically expect of a victim. Who would be open to hearing explanations? This is why I went to breakfast, you know, with the person who raped me during the night. This is why I rode in a car and, you know, acted like nothing was wrong, and, you know, until I got home and told my mother. Those kind of things. And of course, from the defense perspective, I mean, Shannon can talk more about it, obviously, but defendants don't want jurors, obviously, who are thinking, gee, it's about time, you know, guys are just getting away with rape for too long. You know, the worry would be from the point of view of a defendant, you know, this makes it easier for someone to really consent. And then after they think about it and after they go to breakfast with the person and everything, then they cast a bad decision as a rape and revise their description of it or their memory of it. You know, so now they're saying they didn't consent. Those are, you know, we'll face some variation of that in every case. And our response to that, of course, is, you know, ultimately that's a jury question and people should be able to explain, you know, to a jury, you know, if you're telling us you didn't consent and you were never okay with this, then why did you go along with this? Or, you know, explain your thought process as as some time went by before you decided to come forward. You know, Shannon, anything to add on that point? By the way, this is not just a one presentation and the other. I think we've encouraged each other to jump in without shouting objection. So
I'm actually, once Ian's going to go through his presentation, I'm only going to jump in if I have to. But we actually have a really cool piece. We Ian and I both kind of marked up a juror questionnaire. And I actually think we can just go through that. And that's actually a really good forum where I can talk about what kind of experiences I've seen in the range of what jurors feel about consent and what they think they need to see or what the Commonwealth needs to prove, and what kind of questions we should all be asking to get to those points of view. So we'll definitely address that, Ian, but let's do that once we get through the other major components on consent and we can move on to that questionnaire.
Okay, well then I'll plow ahead and I hope everyone's with us. The jury instruction and the law on rape by force and against somebody's will, it's really focused on, it's focused on the acts of the defendant, but the state of mind of the victim. In other words, not what the defendant in particular was thinking at the time, other than a general intent to commit the act. There have been some efforts on the defense side to change that over the years. There have been requests for a, you know, what's called a mistake of fact instruction or defense, or a good faith belief. Essentially, a defendant believing, well, you know, based on how the accuser was behaving, I thought they were fine with it. And the argument being basically, it's not, if I thought the person was consenting, it's not fair to make me read somebody's mind if I thought it was okay based on how they were reacting to me. The SJC and the appeals court have so far refused to allow for that defense and that jury instruction in a case of forcible rape. And this goes back to, there's a Lopez case, 433 Mass 722, if you're keeping score, it's 2001. It was a forcible rape case. The victim was a 17-year-old girl. And the defense version was essentially that the girl was an active and willing participant, and it led the defendant to believe that she was fine, because she told a very different story. But the defendant wanted not only to testify that, you know, in his view, based on his account of the way she behaved, he thought she was fine with it, and so he should get a jury instruction that added that basically he's not guilty if he mistakenly, but honestly, if he honestly believed that the victim had consented. And the SJC went back through the whole history of basically the law of rape in Massachusetts, at least going all the way back to the 19th century and Blackstone and so forth, saying there's never been a requirement in Massachusetts for, you know, that kind of mens rea, to say the defendant must know that the victim is not consenting and must, you know, intend to do it anyway without consent. There are a lot of states and jurisdictions that do allow mistake of fact, but they tend to have statutes that are different, that don't require the same amount of physical force that Massachusetts does. We require the element, and it can't just be, you know, threat of, you know, not giving somebody a job or threat of embarrassing somebody. A rape in Massachusetts under this theory has to be either physical force to overcome, or threatened force to overcome, or constructive force, as that's defined. Anything that's conduct that basically makes the victim fear harm and go along with the act or not resist sufficiently, at least. And the SJC expressed some concern that all of these kind of more understanding concepts for survivors of rape, that resistance might not be possible, that it's not reasonable or fair to expect somebody to resist or explicitly, you know, check a box and say no, or, you know, run screaming away at the first chance or fight. That if you had a mistake of fact defense where somebody could just say, well, gee, you know, I thought that the person was okay with it. They used the language eviscerate. They basically said it would eviscerate all of these concepts that have evolved. They didn't slam the door completely. They said, you know, maybe someday there might be a case, but, you know, we're not going to do that. Go to many years later, Kennedy, I think 2018, 478 Mass 804. The defendant, it was an indecent assault and battery. And the argument was made there for mistake of fact. And the defendant pointed out that, unlike rape, indecent assault and battery does not have an element of force against the person's will. It just has to be an indecent touching to which the person didn't consent. And in Kennedy, the court said, well, there might be a future case for indecent assault and battery, but not in this case, partly because the victim testified that she said no. So where would a mistake of fact come in if the victim said no? You go to Butler, which is a much more recent case, 97 Mass. App 233. That was a case of a police officer on the North Shore who sexually abused a man who was basically in the custody of that police officer in protective custody. The victim was a man who was intoxicated, and the officer committed sexual acts, had taken the guy's clothes away. The guy was naked. The guy was intoxicated. He was in the holding area. And again, the argument was made, well, this should be the case for mistake of fact. And the trial court said no. And the appeals court, I think last year, 2020, said no. They said this, we're mindful that, you know, the court in Kennedy, when they turned it down a couple of years ago, said maybe in some kind of case of indecent AMB, but not this one. The appeals court in Butler said not necessarily that there was, you know, strong evidence of resistance or lack or non-consent, but that the police officer's belief in consent, that the victim was somehow okay with it, would not have been objectively reasonable under those circumstances. So that somebody reasonably in those circumstances could not think that the victim consented. If he's a guy, he's intoxicated, vulnerable, naked, and basically trapped in the police station. So, I mean, I would expect that there will still be people on the lookout for, you know, what's the right case. There's a case that I prosecuted that's on appeal right now that involves an IRS agent. Testimony at trial was that he put a gun in the victim's mouth. And from that point on, she was terrified and basically went along both physically and verbally with what he subjected her to. The request was made by defense counsel for a mistake of fact instruction saying, well, this should be the case because defendant could be mistaken based on, you know, those conversations and that acquiescence. And the trial, ironically, during the trial, we had a Friday morning off because I had to go to the SJC for an argument in a murder case I had. And defense counsel had to go to the appeals court to argue Butler. The very case that was on trial, he was arguing that concept in the appeals court. And the trial judge in our case basically said, I'm going to stick with the law as it stands. And the appeals court in Butler ended up sticking with the law as it stands. So it really is still, what did the defendant do? And did that create a fear in the victim of harm through either actual threatened or constructive force that compelled the victim to submit to the act when the victim didn't consent?
Ian, if I could just jump in, because I know you're probably moving to another topic, but I just want to provide a couple really quick comments on the mistake of fact defense. So Kennedy does a really nice job of explaining why that's not available in a rape case. And really the trigger is the intent element. And Kennedy notes that there's not a requirement for proof of a defendant's knowledge of a victim's lack of consent or intent to engage in non-consensual intercourse. So they need only perform the act by force or threat of force. Now, that's going to change when we move into intoxication, when the next topic Ian's going to get into. But a regular rape case where there's not an allegation that the complainant is unconscious or in a stupor, mistake of fact, or what the defendant knew is not relevant. But differently, in an indecent case, the intent element does require that the defendant intended to commit an indecent or offensive touching without the consent. So that's the trigger, and that's the difference between why mistake of fact could be available. Now, another case, Ian did mention Butler. I'll give that citation one more time. It's 97 Mass Appeals Court 223, and that's a 2020 case. Butler provided a really important distinction that's important for the defense to notice, is that mistake of fact is not necessarily appropriate if you're saying there was consent. Okay, so in some cases, the defense will be grounded in the victim's actual consent. In these situations, the defendant is not claiming to be laboring under a mistake of fact as to whether the victim consented. Instead, the defense is that the defendant intended to and did act with the victim's actual consent. And I would suggest to you in all of the consent cases that I have done, that's the defense. And it's been helpful to see how the courts have treated the mistake of fact defense when requested for an instruction. They're not giving that instruction. And the reason they're not is there's both a subjective and an objective component to trigger that mistake of fact. And what's happening is the courts are looking at the allegations and they're saying, well, maybe the defendant subjectively thought that there was consent, but based on what came into the evidence, and they're necessarily crediting the Commonwealth's version, they're crediting what the complaining witness had testified to, they're saying there's not enough objectively. And I have a feeling we're going to see that repeated over and over again if that instruction is requested in the mean decent cases. And if for some reason we try and apply, widen that and try and get that in the rape cases, and it's probably not going anywhere, but always think about it critically and make the objection. We never know until we appeal it. But I think a mistake of fact defense is appropriate if the defense is adopting a lot of what the Commonwealth's case is. So if you're not really contesting a lot of what the complaining witness is testifying to, and you're basically saying, hey, no, this is a different read on it, a reasonable person, that's the objective component, would look in and say, yeah, maybe there was consent. And that's really been the reason the courts in both Kennedy and Butler denied that mistake of fact jury instruction request. So I just wanted to point those particular factors out, especially from the defense view.
Yeah, Shannon, that's a good point about the distinction between mistake of fact and actual consent as a defense. Like sometimes they work at cross purposes. I mean, because a mistake of fact defense really is, well, gee, maybe I misread the situation, but I thought that the accuser was okay with it. When really what defendants, particularly if they testify, are more often saying are not, gee, I misread the situation, but no, I didn't misread it. There was consent and it was willing. And so that, you know, that alone may undercut a request for a mistake of fact defense. Shannon, you also read my mind in terms of what I was about to say, which is the lack of mistake of fact as, or the state of mind of the defendant being in some ways irrelevant to a rape charge under the force theory changes drastically when you get to incapacitation. Theory of incapacitation essentially is, it's a supplemental instruction. It's under the title, somewhat goofy title, of defendant unconscious or in a stupor. But essentially, it's an act of intercourse where, rather than being forced against their will by actual violence or the threat or fear of violence, they're incapable of consent due to unconsciousness, sleep, intoxication, mental impairment, or some other factor. But there's an additional element that's been baked into the case law, which has to do completely with the defendant's state of mind, which is, and both objectively and subjectively, which is that we, as the prosecutor, have to prove under this theory, not just that the person was incapacitated, but that based on the evidence, based on the circumstances, the defendant either knew or should have known reasonably under the circumstances that the victim was unable to consent. And if that's true, then the only force that's required is literally the force that's necessary to accomplish the act. You know, nothing about overpowering or threats. The knew or should have known element as a practical matter is the most difficult to prove in a lot of cases. It's also the reason that you and the defense bar never see a lot of our cases. And that's because, I mean, on our side, one of the hardest things we do in our job is have a conversation with somebody who is reporting that they have been raped or they believe they've been raped. And even if we find them absolutely credible, we have to look them in the eye and tell them that we don't see a viable rape charge. And I think I work in an office where we're pretty out front in terms of willing to prosecute the tough cases. Our standard is certainly not, we only prosecute things we think we're going to win, because then we might not prosecute any. But I often have to tell somebody some variation on, you know, if you have too much to drink and you don't remember what happened at all, and as it turns out, you know, somebody had sex with you or probably had sex with you, and there's no way you would have consented to that with that person or at all if you had been in your right lucid frame of mind. All that could be 100% true, and you're absolutely right to think that you were violated, but it's not enough to prove a rape, at least not in Massachusetts. And the reason for that is they knew or should have known. Somebody can literally be blackout drunk, no memory of what's happening, no rational decision making, but by outward appearance, can be walking, talking, appearing to, reacting to things, appearing to make conscious decisions. I mean, you know, most people here have some experience. Hopefully it's not yourself being asked these questions, but, you know, in less drastic and horrible circumstances, don't you remember, you know, eating a pizza with us? Don't you remember arguing with the waiter about, you know, who shut you off and wouldn't let you drink? Don't you remember dancing? Don't you remember riding in the cab? Don't you remember kissing that guy? And that's when things start to go toward, you know, our cases. We need actual evidence in those cases, not just the victim's lack of memory or how horrible they felt in the morning, as genuine as that is, either forensic medical proof based on what was in their system that they literally couldn't have been sensible at that point, or a witness who sees somebody who was visibly impaired, not necessarily passed out, but stumbling, not coherent, obviously out of sorts and not making real decisions for themselves, or video evidence. We do have cases where the video actually shows somebody passed out or nearly passed out. Sometimes perpetrators are dumb enough to take video of a victim in that state, either during the act or during the time surrounding it. But it's a pretty high standard for video because, I mean, most of us, you know, sometimes it's decades ago, but most of us have done the OUI cases where there's a booking photo video. If you see somebody in person and they've been drinking a lot, they might be swaying like the old Hancock Building, and you can smell it and everything, and you can look in their eyes and how they're reacting, and they're out of it. But if you look at them on a video, it's just a person standing there and maybe answering questions. The other kind of evidence that we would need in a situation like that, if we don't have some proof of obvious or clear incapacitation that the defendant should have recognized, is an admission by the accused. And those happen. Yeah, the person was passed out. Yeah, they were asleep, but, you know, I'd done it before when they were asleep and I thought it was okay. Of course, that, you know, those do happen. An admission by somebody who really doesn't realize that they've just admitted to a rape, or at least gone partway to admitting to a rape. More often, though, if the police come calling and want to question somebody about an incident with so-and-so, or incident with a woman you met in a bar or at a party or at a gathering, the accused will do, you know, what I might call the second smartest thing they could do, which is to give a version of events that says, yes, we had sex, but I thought the person was fine with it. I had no idea they were so drunk that they don't remember anything, or that they weren't making decisions. They seemed fine to me. They were reacting to me, participating, talking, laughing, etc. And whether we think that suspect's version is true or not. Sometimes we think it's complete baloney and you knew and this person was incapacitated and you raped them. But, you know, we can't charge on that. We can't charge on disbelief of that version if we don't have anything to disprove it. So that kind of version is the second smartest thing that a person questioned by the police can do. Normally, I might ask for a show of hands or somebody to shout out from the audience, but I can certainly ask Shannon, what's the first smartest thing somebody would do?
Invoke their privilege against self-incrimination and not talk to the police. But that does not happen very often. And I'm going to talk at the end about the decision to have a client testify in a consent case. But I frequently see it also with my younger clients, and also when a college or a university is involved and there's a university investigation. A lot of people want to go in and just explain their side of the story. And some of them genuinely don't think they did anything wrong and they want to explain what happened. And they're not thinking they're going to be arrested or even be facing criminal charges. Some of these people have absolutely no criminal records before a case like this. So unfortunately, we see they will come in and try and explain themselves, and there is just no circumstance under which that's appropriate if there's any kind of allegation of an unconsented sexual interaction. That's unflaggingly the correct advice. But I'll talk more about that when we get to the more defense-focused portion.
Okay. I'm going to move into another area, kind of either new or evolving developments, having to do with first, I guess what people might call invalid consent, or consent they think was invalid or improper, not by force, you know, not overcome by force, not by incapacitation where somebody really wasn't in a condition where they could intelligently consent, but a situation where the person is deceived or misled or intimidated into consent, that for some reason they somehow they feel like they have to consent. I'll start with the deceived or misled aspect, which is, suppose we'll call the person the suspect and the accuser. It's a little more nuanced than defendant and victim. Suppose a suspect initiates intercourse with an accuser and the accuser goes along with it, thinking it's their intimate partner. Maybe it's dark, maybe the person's behind them. But it turns out, and they soon become aware that it's not. It's somebody else who came into their room and jumped into bed with them. Or it's somebody else who woke them up literally while they were sleeping on the street or in an MBTA station. These are cases that actually happen multiple times. People sleeping in doorways, people sleeping on the ground at South Station, and somebody comes along and sexually assaults them. Now that's the scenario I just described. That was consent obtained either by the suspect's deliberate falsehood, or the mistaken belief of the second person, the who becomes the accuser. Second scenario, suppose the bad guy, and I have no problem calling him the bad guy in this case, because suppose it's somebody who says, I'm a doctor, I need to examine you, and commit some act of penetration on your body under the guise of being a doctor, either an exam, or we've had cases where somebody said, I'm a doctor and I'm doing a medical study, I'll pay you $20 to participate in this study, and I need to do an exam. And turns out either the person is not a doctor, he's just a pervert, or the person is a doctor, but the intrusion was completely unnecessary for whatever medical purpose was at hand. Now, can either of those be rape? And the answer in Massachusetts is no. rape in Massachusetts can only be accomplished by the two theories we already talked about, either force against the person's will or when they are incapacitated. And being deceived does not count as being incapacitated. Being deceived, you know, I thought he was a doctor and therefore I couldn't really consent. That's not recognized as overcoming consent for purposes of rape. But it is for indecent assault and battery. For the same reason that there's a little more room for argument, perhaps on the mistake of fact issue in indecent assault and battery, because there isn't the element of force, you know, overcoming the victim. For an indecent assault and battery, it really is an intentional touching that has the element of indecency, either because either where the person's touched specifically or the surrounding circumstances. Commonwealth versus De La Cruz, 15 Mass App Court 52 in 1982, was pretty close to the doctor scenario I just described. And it was a doctor who, was conducting an exam, and it wasn't an act of penetration. It was just it was an indecent assault and battery, and he was convicted and argued that, this was, this should be treated like rape law because it's a sexual assault. And the appeals court pretty much summarily rejected that argument and said, it's simply wrong to say that force to overcome the will of the victim is an element of indecent assault and battery. It's not. Now, one type of kind of deceptively obtained consent that's come up lately is what's known as stealthing. It's fairly new. It's fairly new nationwide. We have a couple of cases that are charged that way. Stealthing is essentially consent based on the perpetrator's promise to use a condom, and then they don't. And there's a lot of debate over it. A lot of people who think it should be charged as rape. A lot of people who think it shouldn't be charged as a crime at all. Where we've come down, if in an appropriate case where there's viable evidence, is there are some cases that are charged as indecent assault and battery that way. Essentially, it can't be a rape charge because there's no element of overwhelming force or of incapacitation. But there is evidence of an intentional touching, and the consent falsely obtained is lack of consent for purposes of indecent assault and battery. That doesn't address the many other scenarios out there for which there's increased public awareness, things that are considered, I guess, sexual misconduct that colloquially might be called sexual assault. Person was my boss. What was I supposed to do? I went along with it. Person was my professor, or I needed a recommendation, or I really needed not to fail that class, or they were a cop and I thought I would get in trouble. None of those situations, if they don't have actual force or if they don't have incapacitation, is a rape under our law. It may, it's sleazy. It may be a tort. It may be something that can get them sued or fired. Or rightly condemned, but it's not something that can get them criminally prosecuted. Keep in mind, whether the defendant is in a position of authority like that is certainly a factor to consider when consent is the disputed element, and why somebody might not resist, why somebody might feel that going along with it was their only option. But there still has to be the element of force. It can't simply be I was uncomfortable or I was intimidated or I feared some other consequences in my life beside force. That brings me to the last aspect of what I'm going to talk about, which is, I mentioned a police officer. There has been for a long time a statute called sexual conduct with a prisoner, which is basically, if you're a correction officer in a prison or in a sheriff's jail facility, then a prisoner in your custody is deemed not to be capable of consent to sexual conduct of any kind. And it's a 5-year felony, whether it's, you know, whether it's intercourse, whether it's touching. So in that sense, it's kind of a strict liability offense. There are efforts in the legislature over the years to expand that because it was always not a crime for a police officer or a court officer or any number of other people with the power to restrict people's freedom, to handcuff them, to lock them up. It was never a crime for any of those people to have sex with somebody in their custody, as long as it wasn't a forcible rape. I prosecuted a case in Essex with a court officer, sexual conduct that he admitted with somebody who was a prisoner in the district court lockup, waiting for a case to be called. He was convicted of a different offense in that case, but prosecution lost that trial on the issue of really was it forcible rape under the law. The jury was out for quite a while, but they came back not guilty on those. Effective January 1st, 2021, this year, a few years too late for that, the legislature changed it. I'm going to share the screen and show people what happened. It's part of the criminal justice reform bill, big sweeping measures that passed at the end of last year amid all the debate about police brutality, about misconduct, about rethinking the role of police. And in the process of this, these two provisions kind of came through quietly. There wasn't a lot of fanfare with them. And I'm supposed to be abreast of all these things, and I kind of stumbled upon it after it happened. And it basically ups the penalty and ups the risk for law enforcement officers. Says a law enforcement officer who has sexual intercourse with a person in the custody control of that officer is guilty of rape. It's a new subsection to the rape statute and says in black and white, the person in the law enforcement's custody shall be deemed incapable of consent. In other words, just like a child would be, just like a person with a recognized mental or developmental impairment would be deemed incapable of consent. Same thing with indecent assault and battery. Law enforcement officer who commits an indecent assault and battery under a person who has attained the age of 14, which is basically an indecent touching against somebody in their custody, is guilty of indecent A and B. And then the next part of that provision says a person in custody shall be deemed incapable of consent. In other words, all you have to prove is an indecent touching and that the defendant was a law enforcement officer who had that person in their custody. So what do those terms mean? And these are the big changes too. Because law enforcement, it's no longer just correction officers in the jails or prisons who are subject to this. A law enforcement officer now means any police officer, any special or part-time or reserve police officer, in other words, anybody who's given police powers under our law. That includes police officers on all the college campuses, whether they're the full accredited departments like BU and BC and Harvard and so on, UMass, or whether they're just special police officers who only have police powers on their campuses. Next phrase is public prosecutor. That's us. That's ADAs. Emergency medical technicians, because there are situations where EMTs, by the way, carry handcuffs. I don't know if everybody knows that, but they do. It's meant to be to control people who are maybe having a breakdown or a crisis and are uncontrollable or violent, but they too are legally empowered to restrict somebody's freedom of movement. deputy sheriff or correction officer like before, although now they're subject to the full penalties for indecent A and B or rape. Court officer in a courthouse, probation or parole officer, anywhere, somebody who works for DYS who has the power to lock a kid up, basically. Somebody who's a constable. Those of you who are in smaller towns, you may know you have constables. Sometimes they're elected. They serve process. They post notices, but they also have police powers. I mean, Brookline, where I live, one of the constables for a long time was Tommy Vitolo, who's now the state representative. And it was always hard to picture him ever slapping the cuffs on everybody. And I don't know if he ever did, but somebody like that now would be subject to this statute. And then this is interesting, a person impersonating any of the foregoing, which means a defendant who pretends to be a police officer taking somebody into their custody or control, and has sex with them. And then you see I put a big question mark at the bottom. And that's because, you know, what would a Massachusetts statute be without a nice big area for future litigation and questions, you know, cases that are going to be left to the devices of the prosecutors and the defense attorneys to hash out, and the trial judges to guess at what it means, and the appellate courts maybe to decide the question, maybe to decide it as narrowly as they can and say, we leave for another day the rest of this stuff so that we continue to fight about it and grope in the dark for years. I mean, I think people have a pretty good idea of what's at one end of the custody spectrum, which is a police officer or a DYS worker or anybody has somebody in handcuffs, you're coming with me. What does that mean? Does it extend to a threshold detention, you know, the so-called Terry stop, where a police officer stops somebody? They're obviously not free to leave at that point, but they're not placed under arrest. I mean, I would say probably yes. Where does a public prosecutor come in? How could somebody in my job somehow be charged with something like this? Well, what if we as the assistant DA are the ones who are responsible for getting somebody habed into the courthouse to testify in grand jury, and they're in a room, you know, ready to be interviewed and, you know, to see if they're, you know, to see what they'd say in the grand jury. Basically, it's the legislature, surprisingly, and I think pleasantly surprisingly, expanded this really to encompass a lot of different people who can have the power to restrict somebody's movement. The last observation I'll make about this is it's also an example of how in this whole area, kind of the politics and the policy lines really blur, and they blur between those of us on different sides of the V. Is this statute, you know, conservative and pro-prosecution? Well, I mean, it certainly creates a new crime. It subjects more people than before to punishment, and it reduces the burden of proof on the Commonwealth, to punish them.
All right.
On the other hand,
I'm gonna jump in, Ian, because we're running out of time, and I want to hit on some defense things, and I want to start talking about the jury selection. We want to talk about 2021, so we want to talk about some issues that are going on right now. So I'm just going to go through really quickly a couple of things that this is directed at the defense bar. If you get a consent case, a lot of times you'll know early on if the case is going to be a consent case. Sometimes you have to live with it because of the facts, maybe because of a statement your client made. But it's important that you hit the ground running the second you get a case. You need to hire an investigator immediately. You need to interview every single person who is at the party or in contact with the complaining witness, with your client. You need to bring your client in, and you need or go visit them in custody and get an as detailed client interview as possible. And then you need to have the diligence to write really good notes about that interview and follow up on every piece. And the reason that is so important is because these cases can sometimes take years to go to trial. Usually, I haven't seen a case go to trial in less than 2 years now with COVID. And the client will remember everything really well right after the incident. And it's going to be a long interview. Take the time. And then if you end up having a client testify, and I'm going to talk about that briefly, having this account is actually really helpful to help the client testify. Because by the time you go to prep him, usually the clients are male, but sometimes a female, when you go to prep them for trial, they may not really remember too well, but you can grab your notes out and say, hey, remember we talked about this at this time, and you know, this is some of the things, and that actually really will help them refresh that memory. In a consent case, I actually think the defense a lot of times carries a little bit of a burden, in the sense that we may really need to put on some evidence. As I had mentioned before, sometimes there's things that need to be explained. Text messages that can be taken out of context, interviews or statements with the client. I've had situations where the police are kind of all over the place and they jump from point A to point C and client can't really explain it. But then when you get them in for that important interview, you can get from the beginning to the end and you see exactly what happened and exactly what the client's side of the story is. And that, of course, didn't come through in an interrogation. So, and I also will talk to a client very early on about the possibility that they may need to testify. I say that's a decision we'll make later, but don't talk to anyone about this case. And hang on to, you know, that video, that cell phone preservation. There was just a lecture on that. I can't tell you how many times I've had a client's cell phone extracted with the CellBrite extraction. One important thing to remember is that the CellBrite does not preserve emojis. CellBrite still doesn't. It's an error. It just doesn't. I talked to my experts about it. An emoji will be a square block. And so it's important to also do screenshots. And I think the most important, if there is a contested, the heart of the case is a text message chain or some other app, get screenshots and then also do an extraction. I think that's the most thorough way to do it. Get it all done immediately. You have to put a ton of work into a case initially, be prepared for that. And if you don't have the time or if you're on trial, don't take a case like that. Give it to somebody else or get someone else to help you out in the beginning. So with that said, I'd like to talk a little bit about jury voir dire, and I am going to share my screen, which is a juror questionnaire. And Ian and I doctored this up a little bit just to kind of start brainstorming. And a juror questionnaire is a tool, and make sure that this you use this as a gateway to talk to your jurors and not as a substitute to talk to your jurors. So if someone comes up and they've checked no to every single question on that questionnaire, that doesn't mean they get through. That doesn't mean they sit on your jury. You still need to think of questions to ask them and interact with them, because having that conversation and making that connection and seeing their demeanor is really important to assessing whether or not that person is an appropriate juror. So these are really standard, and this will be in your materials. These are really standard questions. I'm not going to go through them all. Ian's additions are in the blue. And you start to see, I challenge you all, when you're thinking of questions to ask the jurors, to get outside the box of, could you be fair and impartial? Remove that phrase from your vocabulary. If the judge wants to use it, fine, but everyone's going to say they can be fair and impartial. And I challenge you to completely remove that from what you're going to be asking about the jurors. I encourage you to make the questions less formal, make them conversational, make them something that's going to get them talking, maybe a little bit like kind of shocking. And you're going to see this in some of these red questions. So I like to, number six is one of my favorite questions, is to say, is there anything, do you have a reaction to this case? You heard the allegations read when you came in. Is there anything about the nature of these charges? And write what these charges are about. Is this maybe a sadism masochism case? Is this a date rape case? Write what this is. Does it make it difficult for you to be here? Did you have a reaction to hearing about this case? Number seven is along the same lines. This might be really graphic. I love what Ian added. Can you not only listen to this evidence, but you're going to have to talk to 11 strangers about it. So what is your comfort level with that? And this would actually be two different boxes because you're asking two different questions, but I would change the formatting about that. What kind of experiences are these own jurors getting into? And have you been affected by information? I wouldn't even say, have you been exposed to information? Have you been influenced? Has this information impacted you? You're going to see some questions on the Me Too movement. And these questions, these morality questions here, and Ian's going to comment on it because I think he doesn't quite like them, but these morality questions are important because I think this gets a juror talking. And I asked number 12 at one of my trials, do you think it's wrong for a man to have sex with a woman who has been drinking? And I am so glad I asked it this way because I really got the views of a juror. And let me tell you, there is a huge generational divide on what is appropriate behavior while drinking. The younger generation is taught not to be having sex while they're drinking. They may feel very different about consent. And I actually, these questions about consent I have not asked before, but I drafted for this MCLE. Do you think consent to engage in sexual intercourse only occurs when both parties explicitly say yes? There are jurors out there who feels that way. And similarly, if there's no evidence that both parties say yes to sex, could sex still occur? So what kind of behaviors and things are in here? And there's other questions you guys can look at. We'll really run out of time. Ian, do you want to jump in and respond to this while we have maybe half a minute? Probably we're over, but.
Yeah, no, sure, thanks. I think in general, I've had a few cases with questionnaires that were written. I had one that was actually a lot more extensive than this with Attorney Jay Carney, where it was a very detailed questionnaire that had no yes, if yes, please explain, and the person had his face to write something. I think they're very useful, and I think that in general, getting deep into these issues is a good idea, and I think that it's been surprisingly easy to get common ground on most of these questions. If there are a few questions that the two sides really disagree on, then you throw it to the judge. And the judge, generally, the reactions I've seen is, okay, you know, this isn't the hill to die on. I'm not going to ask that question. You can see the questions that I suggested and pulled out of that longer questionnaire that I talked about at the end. My hesitation about the kind of morality, there are the morality questions and then the kind of quasi-legal questions, things like, do you believe that somebody can consent if they've been drinking? And the reason I think I would probably object to that particular question is that there are going to be tons of people who may have their own conception, which turned out to be a misconception about what the law is. And, you know, they're going to be asked, whatever you think, can you accept what the judge says the law is? We don't ask people in a murder case, you know, do you think that, premeditation has to involve, you know, advanced planning, something like that. You know, we leave that for the judge to explain. In terms of the morality questions, it's challenging, and I agree that area in terms of people's feelings about scenarios should be explored. I would, if I had my druthers and could control what the judge did, would rather stick with the questions that set forth the type of scenario and make them open-ended. You know, what kind of feelings does that evoke? Rather than kind of the straight morality questions that really can cut both ways. I mean, if you talk about old...
And I agree it cuts both ways. And I think if you ask too much of an open-ended question, you're going to get a juror. And I love open-ended questions, but I find you're going to have a juror who's going to be a bit like a deer in the headlights. And maybe not give you a great answer. And I think the judge, the prosecutor, and myself has an interest in an efficient yet probative voir dire of each particular person that comes up. So why I like these morality questions is it just gets right to the heart of the issue. And it phrases the question in an interesting way that's likely to elicit a response. And I also asked, so this here, do you think a person who's been drinking can consent to sex? I asked that question too. So that was not a new question. Everyone's answer was fantastic. I don't know. It depends on the level. Great. That's exactly what this case is about. Thank you, sir, or ma'am, and move on. I think it's totally different than asking about premeditation. This is something, drinking and sex is something that everyone, nearly everyone has had experience with and they have opinions on. And getting to the basis of that and where those, what preconceptions exist and asking these questions in a way that's interesting and will get them talking about it instead of just some kind of vague, how do you feel about consent or what is consent or what do you, it just, it starts getting too squishy. So I think if you agenda set a little bit, an appropriate way to get them talking about it is a great way to kind of get some views on, get some views from the jurors. I find that they are really willing to talk about their views. I know with my first sexual assault case, I was nervous that they wouldn't want to be kind of talking about sex and consent and stuff. But I think once you get them talking about it, and it's, the questionnaire is helpful because they've already seen it. They've been exposed to that question. They've lived with it for 15 minutes or 2 hours or however long. Then they're prepared to come up and talk about it in a meaningful way. And my, our training unit, the CPCS training unit would probably come in and say, well, they're not deselection questions. So they would tell the defense bar, be really careful, you know, only answer the question that's going to weed out the jurors that you don't want. And there's certainly, and the Commonwealth has probably been trained the same way. There's certainly an insight to that, but sometimes I'm willing to sacrifice that to just find out what people think and feel. And now that we've got this attorney-conducted voir dire, I'm willing to kind of jump in there and see how people really feel because there's so many loaded thoughts and feelings, especially with the Me Too movement, that come into play. And you just, you need to be asking about it. And I challenge you all to think of creative ways. Don't copy and paste that same questionnaire from 2013. Be creative. Reword the questions. Change your questionnaire every time. If there's something in the news right at the time, ask about it. I tried a case right when that, when Taylor Swift accused that DJ of, I think it was touching her inappropriately. And I asked about it and people had some opinions. Some people had never heard about it, but people had some opinions on it. So I think that's a really important concept and you need to spend some time thinking about what questions and how you want to ask them to your jury. And talk to people and to kind of close out about in 2021, talk to people, go to a dinner party, talk to if you're only exposed to a certain age range, see if you can get exposed to a younger generation or an older generation and just kind of talk to them about what they feel about sex and consent and drinking. And they'll have opinions on it and you'll get a really good feel of what kind of how people feel about this out there, and you can structure questions to elicit those answers or at least elicit those opinions to make sure you get an appropriate jury.
I unfortunately, we've had to go into our break a little bit. Shannon, did you have any closing thoughts or are you good?
That was pretty much all I had. I also provided this will be in the materials, a special instruction for a complainant who's intoxicated or in a stupor. I've actually talked about this every single time I presented at MCLE, so just take a look at that instruction. It's really important that you suggest a more definitive explanation of what level of intoxication is needed because the current jury instructions do not account for that. And if you have any questions, please reach out to me. I'm happy. I get calls. I love when I get calls from you guys after this to talk. I'm happy to crunch a case or send pleadings or anything. I'm happy to do that. So my email is sbyrnes, B-Y-R-N-E-S, at publiccounsel.net, and encourage you to do that. Thank you, Julie.
Excellent. Well, I want to take a second here. Thank you, Shannon. Thank you, Ian. This was excellent. Still an evolving issue, and it seems to you're absolutely changed. It changes with the times on what we view as appropriate and inappropriate, although the law has remained the same. So this was great. Thank you both so much today. For everyone who's still awake and watching, we are going to take a break until 4:10. So luckily, there shouldn't be a line at the bathroom at your home, and we will come back.